They met in college dorm rooms, first of all, amid clouds of cigarette smoke, chattering animatedly among themselves, as students do, and like students everywhere, they combined idealism with passion. That passion soon turned to resolve. By midnight, they were meeting in larger groups. Some leaders emerged, and, being leaders, they felt the need to take their associates somewhere. When the crowds mingled outside, the individual leaders of smaller groups met and started talking. And super leaders emerged, rather like an instant military or political hierarchy, absorbing other groups into their own, until there were 6 principal leaders of a group of about 1,500 students. The larger group developed and then fed upon its own energy. Students everywhere are well supplied with piss and vinegar, and these Chinese students were no different. Some of the boys were there hoping to score with girls, another universal motivation for students. But the unifying factor here was rage at what had happened to their soldiers and their country, and even more rage at the lies that had gone out over state TV. Lies so clearly and utterly refuted by the reality they saw over the Internet, a source they'd learned to trust. There was only one place for them to go, Tiananmen Square, the square of heavenly peace, the psychological center of their country, and they were drawn there like iron filings to a magnet. The time of day worked for them. The police in Beijing, like police everywhere, worked 24-hour days divided into 3 unequal shifts, and the shift most lightly manned was that from 2300 to 0700. Most people were asleep then, and as a direct result, there was little crime to suppress, and so this shift was the smallest in terms of manning, and also composed of those officers loved the least by their commanders, because no man in his right mind prefers the vampire life of wakefulness in darkness to that in the light of day. And so the few police on duty were those who had failed to distinguish themselves in their professional skills, or were disliked by their captains, and returned the compliment by not taking their duties with sufficient gravity. The appearance of the first students in the square was barely noted by the 2 policemen there. Their main duties involved directing traffic, and, or telling, frequently inebriated foreign tourists how to stumble back to their hotels. And the only danger they faced was usually that of being blinded by the flashes of foreign cameras held by oafishly pleasant but drunken guai. This new situation took them totally by surprise, and their first reaction was to do nothing but watch. The presence of so many young people in the square was unusual, but they weren't doing anything overtly unlawful at the moment, and so the police just looked on in a state of bemusement. They didn't even report what was going on because the watch captain was an ass who wouldn't have known what to do about it anyway. "What if they strike at our nuclear arms?" Interior Minister Tong Jie asked. "They already have," Zhang reminded them. "They sank our missile submarine, you will recall. If they also strike at our land-based missiles, then it would mean they plan to attack us as a nation, not just our armed forces, for then they would have nothing to hold them back. It would be a grave and deliberate provocation, is that not so, Shen?" The foreign minister nodded. "It would be an unfriendly act." "How do we defend against it?" Tan Dexi asked. "The missile field is located far from the borders. Each is in a heavily constructed concrete silo," Defense Minister Luo explained. "Moreover, we have recently fortified them further with steel armor to deflect bombs that might fall on them. The best way to add to their defense would be to deploy surface-to-air missiles." "And if the Americans use their stealthy bombers, then what?" Tan asked. "The defense against that is passive. The steel hats we put on the silos. We have troops there. Security personnel of 2nd Artillery Command. But they are there only for site security against intruders on the ground. If such an attack should be made, we should launch them. The principle is to use them or lose them. An attack against our strategic weapons would have to be a precursor to an attack against our nationhood. That is our one trump card," Luo explained. the one thing that even the Americans truly fear.
Well, it should be, Zhang Hansan agreed. That is how we tell the Americans where they must stop and what they must do. In fact, it might now be a good time to tell the Americans that we have those missiles, and the willingness to use them if they press us too hard.
Threaten the Americans with nuclear arms? Fang asked. Is that wise? They know of our weapons, surely. An overt threat against a powerful nation is most unwise.
They must know that there are lines they may not cross, Zhang insisted.
They can hurt us, yes, but we can hurt them. And this is one weapon against which they have no defense. And their sentimentality for their people works for us, not them. It is time for America to regard us as an equal, not a minor country whose power they can blithely ignore.
I repeat, comrade, Fang said, that would be a most unwise act. When someone points a gun at your head, you do not try to frighten him.
Fang, you have been my friend for many years, but in this you are wrong. It is we who hold that pistol now. The Americans only respect strength controlled by resolve. This will make them think. Luo, are the missiles ready for launch?
The defense minister shook his head.
No, yesterday we did not agree to ready them. To do so takes about 2 hours, to load them with fuel. After that they can be kept in a ready condition for about 48 hours. Then you defuel them, service them. It takes about 4 hours to do that. And you can refuel them again. We could easily maintain half of them in a ready-launch condition indefinitely.
Comrades, I think it is in our interest to ready the missiles for flight.
No, Fang countered. That will be seen by the Americans as a dangerous provocation, and provoking them this way is madness.
And we should have Shen remind the Americans that we have such weapons, and they do not, Zhang went on.
That invites an attack on us, Fang nearly shouted. They do not have rockets, yes, but they have other ways of attacking us. And if we do that now, when a war is already underway, we guarantee a response.
I think not, Fang, Zhang replied.
They will not gamble millions of their citizens against all of ours. They have not the strength for such gambling.
Gambling, you say?
Do we gamble with the life of our country?
Zhang, you are mad. This is lunacy, Fang insisted.
I do not have a vote at this table, Xian observed. But I have been a party member all of my adult life, and I have served the People's Republic well, I think. It is our job here to build a country, not destroy it. What have we done here? We've turned China into a thief, a highway robber, and a failed highway robber at that. Luo has said it. We have lost our play for riches, and now we must adjust to that. We can recover from the damage we have done to our country and its people. But recovery will require humility on our part, not blustering defiance. To threaten the Americans now is an act of weakness, not strength. It's the act of an impotent man trying to show off his gao. It will be seen by them as a foolish and reckless act.
If we are to survive as a nation, if we are to survive as the rulers of a powerful China, Zhang countered, we must let the Americans know that they cannot push us farther.
Comrades, make no mistake. Our lives lie on this table.
And that focused the discussion.
I do not suggest that we launch a nuclear strike on America. I propose that we demonstrate to America our resolve, and if they press us too far, then we will punish them. And the Russians. Comrades, I propose that we fuel up our missiles, to place them in a ready posture, and then have Shen tell the Americans that there are limits beyond which we cannot be pushed without the gravest possible consequences.
No, Fang retorted.
That is tantamount to the threat of nuclear war. We must not do such a thing.
If we do not, then we are all doomed, said Tan Dashi of the Ministry of State Security.
I am sorry, Fang, but Zhang is correct here. Those are the only weapons with which we can hold the Americans back. They will be tempted to strike at them. And if they do,
then we must use them, because if they take those weapons away from us, then they can strike us at will, and destroy all we have built in 60 years, Zhang concluded. I call a vote. Suddenly and irrationally, Fang thought, the meeting had struck out on a path with no logic or direction, leading to disaster. But he was the only one who saw this, as for the first time in his life he took a stand against the others. The meeting finally broke up. The Politburo members drove directly home. None of them passed through Tiananmen Square on the way, and all of them fell rapidly asleep. There were 25 UH-60A Blackhawks and 15 Apaches on the ramp. Every one had stubby wings affixed to the fuselage. Those on the Blackhawks were occupied with fuel tanks. The Apaches had both fuel and rockets. The flight crews were grouped together, looking at maps. Clark took the lead. He was dressed in his black ninja gear, and a soldier directed him and Karelin. He was in the snowflake camouflage used by Russian airborne troops, to Colonel Boyle. Howdy, Dick Boyle. I'm John Clark, and this is Lieutenant General Yuri Karelin. I'm Rainbow, John explained. He's Spetsnaz. Boyle saluted. Well, I'm your driver, gentlemen. The objective is 716 miles away. We can just about make it with the fuel we're carrying, but we're going to have to tank up on the way back. We're doing that right here. He pointed to a spot on the navigation chart. Hilltop west of this little town named Chichang. We got lucky. Two C-130s are going to do bladder drops for us. There will be a fighter escort for top cover, F-15s, plus some F-16s to go after any radars along the way. And when we get to about here, 8 F-117s are going to trash this fighter base at Anshan. That should take care of any Chinese fighter interference. Now, this missile base has an associated security force, supposed to be battalion strength, in barracks located here. This time it was a satellite photo. And 5 of my Apaches are going to take that place down with rockets. The others will be flying direct support. The only other question is, how close do you want us to put you on these missile silos? Land right on top of the bastards, Clark told him, looking over at Karelin. I agree. The closer the better. Boyle nodded. Fair enough. The helicopters all have numbers on them indicating the silo they're flying for. I'm flying lead, and I'm going right to this one here. That means I go with you, Clark told him. How many? 10 plus me. Okay, your chem gear's in the aircraft. Suit up and we go. Latrines that way, Boyle pointed. It would be better for every man to take a piss before the flight began. 15 minutes. Clark went that way, and so did Karelin. Both old soldiers knew what they needed to do in most respects, and this one was as vital as loading a weapon. Have you been to China before, John? Nope. Taiwan once, long ago, to get screwed, blued, and tattooed. No chance for that on this trip. We are both too old for this, you know. I know, Clark said, zipping himself up. But you're not going to sit back here, are you? Our leader must be with his men, Ivan Timofeyevich. That is true, Yuri. Good luck. They will not launch a nuclear attack on my country, or on yours, Karelin promised. Not while I live. You know, Yuri, you might have been a good guy to have in Third SOG. And what is that, John? When we get back and have a few drinks, I will tell you. The troops suited up outside their designated helicopters. The U.S. Army chemical gear was bulky, but not grossly so. Like many American issue items, it was an evolutionary development of a British idea, with charcoal inside the lining to absorb and neutralize toxic gas, and a hood that... We can't use our radios with this, Mike Pierce noted. Screws up the antenna. Try this, Homer Johnston suggested, disconnecting the antenna and tucking it into the helmet cover. Good one, Homer, Eddie Price said, watching what he did and trying it himself. The American pattern Kevlar helmet fit nicely into the hoods, which they left off in any case as too uncomfortable until they really needed it. That done, they loaded into their helicopters, and the flight crews spooled up the General Electric turboshaft engines. The Blackhawks lifted off. The special operations troops were set in what were, for military aircraft, comfortable seats, held in place with 4-point safety belts. Clark took the jump seat, aft and between the two pilots, and tied into the intercom. "Who exactly are you?" Boyle asked. "Well, I have to kill you after I tell you, but I'm CIA. Before that, Navy." "Seal?" Boyle asked. "Budweiser badge and all. A couple years ago, we set up this group called Rainbow, Special Operations, Counter-Terror, that sort of thing." "The amusement park job?" "That's us." "You had a 60 supporting you for that. Who's the driver?" "Dan Malloy. Goes by Bear when he's driving. Know him?" "Marine, right?"
"Yep."
Clark nodded.
"Never met him. Heard about him a little. I think he's in D.C. now."
"Yeah, when he left us, he took over VMH-1.
"Flies the president?"
"Correct."
"Bummer," Boyle observed.
"How long you been doing this?"
"Flying choppers? Oh, 18 years. 4,000 hours. I was born in the Huey and grew up into these. Qualified in the Apache, too."
"What do you think of the mission?" John asked.
"Long," was the reply, and Clark hoped that was the only cause for concern.
A sore ass you could recover from quickly enough.
"I wish there was another way to do this one, Robbie," Ryan said over lunch. It seemed utterly horrid to be sitting here in the White House mess, eating a cheeseburger with his best friend, while others, including two people he knew well, Jack had learned, were heading into harm's way. It was enough to kill his appetite, as dead as the low-cholesterol beef in the bun. He set it down and sipped at his Coke.
"Well, there is. If you want to wait the 2 days it's going to take Lockheed Martin to assemble the bombs, then a day to fly them to Siberia, and another 12 hours to fly the mission. Maybe longer. The Black Jet only flies at night, remember," the Vice President pointed out.
"You're handling it better than I am."
"Jack, I don't like it any more than you do, okay? But after 20 years of flying off carriers, you learn to handle the stress of having friends in tight corners. If you don't, might as well turn in your wings.
Eat, man. You need your strength.
How's Andrea doing?"
That generated an ironic smile. "Puked her guts out this morning. Had her use my own crapper. It's killing her. She was embarrassed as a guy caught naked in Times Square."
"Well, she's in a man's job, and she doesn't want to be seen as a wimp," Robbie explained. "Hard to be one of the boys when you don't have a dick, but she tries real hard. I'll give her that."
"Kathy says it passes, but it isn't passing fast enough for her." He looked over to see Andrea standing in the doorway, always the watchful protector of her president.
"She's a good troop," Jackson agreed.
"How's your dad doing?"
"Not too bad. Some TV ministry agency wants him and Jerry Patterson to do some more salt and pepper shows on Sunday mornings. He's thinking about it. The money could dress up the church some."
"They were impressive together."
"Yeah, Jerry didn't do bad for a white boy. And he's actually a pretty good guy, Pap says. I'm not sure of this TV ministry stuff, though. Too easy to go Hollywood and start playing to the audience instead of being a shepherd to your flock."
"Your father's a pretty impressive gent, Robbie."
Jackson looked up.
"I'm glad you think so.
He raised us pretty good, and it was pretty tough on him after Mom died. But he can be a real sundowner. Gets all pissy when he sees me drink a beer. But what the hell, it's his job to yell at people, I suppose.
Tell him that Jesus played bartender once. It was his first public miracle."
"I've pointed that out, and then he says, 'If Jesus wants to do it, that's okay for Jesus, boy, but you ain't Jesus.'"
The Vice President had a good chuckle.
"Eat, Jack."
"Yes, Mom."
"This food isn't half bad," Al Gregory said, 2 miles away in the wardroom of USS Gettysburg.
Well, no women and no booze on a ship of war, Captain Blandy pointed out. Not this one yet, anyway. You have to have some diversion. So, how are the missiles?
The software is fully loaded, and I emailed the upgrade, like you said. So all the other Aegis ships ought to have it.
Just heard this morning that the Aegis office in the Pentagon is having a bit of a conniption fit over this. They didn't approve the software.
Tell him to take it up with Tony Britano, Gregory suggested.
Explain to me again, what exactly did you upgrade?
The Seeker software on the missile warhead.
I cut down the lines of code so it can recycle more quickly.
And I reprogrammed the mutation rate on the laser on the fusing system so that I can handle a higher rate of closure.
It should obviate the problem the Patriots had with the Scuds back in 91. I helped with that software fix, too, back then, but this one's about half an order of magnitude faster.
Without a hardware fix? The skipper asked.
It would be better to increase the range of the laser, yes, but you can get away without it. At least it worked okay on the computer simulations.
Hope to hell we don't need to prove it.
Oh, yeah, Captain. A nuke headed for a city is a bad thing.
Amen.
There were 5,000 of them now, with more coming, summoned by the cell phones that they all seemed to have. Some even had portable computers tied into cellular phones so that they could tap into the internet site out here in the open. It was a clear night, with no rain to wreck a computer. The leaders of the crowd, they now thought of it as a demonstration, huddled around them to see more, and then relayed it to their friends. The first big student uprising in Tiananmen Square had been fueled by faxes. This one had taken a leap forward in technology. Mainly, they milled around, talking excitedly with one another and summoning more help. The first such demonstration had failed, but they'd all been toddlers then, and their memory of it was sketchy at best. They were all old and educated enough to know what needed changing, but not yet old and experienced enough to know that change in their society was impossible. And they didn't know what a dangerous combination that could be.
The ground below was dark and unlit. Even their night vision goggles didn't help much, showing only rough terrain features, mainly the tops of hills and ridges. There were few lights below. There were some houses and other buildings, but at this time of night few people were awake, and all of the lights were turned off. The only moving light sources they could see were the rotor tips of the helicopters, heated by air friction to the point that they would be painful to touch, and hot enough to glow in the infrared spectrum that the night goggles could detect. Mainly the troops were lulled into stuporous lassitude by the unchanging vibration of the aircraft, and the semi-dreaming state that came with it helped to pass the time. That was not true of Clark, who sat in the jump seat, looking down at the satellite photos of the missile base at Chuan Hua, studying by the illumination of the IR light on his goggles, looking for information he might have missed on first and 21st inspection. He was confident in his men. Chavez had turned into a fine tactical leader, and the troops, experienced sergeants all, would do what they were told to the extent of their considerable abilities. The Russians in the other helicopters would do okay too, he thought. Younger, by 8 years on average, than the Rainbow Troopers, they were all commissioned officers, mainly lieutenants and captains with a leavening of a few majors, and all were university graduates, well-educated, and that was almost as good as 5 years in uniform. Better yet, they were well-motivated young professional soldiers, smart enough to think on their feet, and proficient in their weapons. The mission should work, John thought. He leaned to check the clock on the helicopter's instrument panel. 40 minutes, and they'd find out. Turning around, he noticed the eastern sky was lightening, according to his goggles. They'd hit the missile field just before dawn. It was a stupidly easy mission for the black jets. Arriving overhead singly, about 30 seconds apart, each opened its bomb bay doors and dropped two weapons, 10 seconds apart. Each pilot, his plane controlled by its automatic cruising system, put his laser dot on a pre-planned section of the runway. The bombs were the earliest Paveway 2 guidance packages bolted to Mark 84 2,000-pound bombs with cheap, $7.95 each, in fact, M905 fuses set to go off a hundredth of a second after impact, so as to make a hole in the concrete about 20 feet across by 9 feet deep. And this all 16 of them did, to the shocked surprise of the sleepy tower crew, and with enough noise to wake up every person within a 5-mile radius. And just that fast, Anshan Fighter Base was closed, and would remain so for at least a week. The 8 F-117s turned singly and made their way back to their base at Zhigansk. Flying the black jet wasn't supposed to be any more exciting than driving a 737 for Southwest Airlines. And, for the most part, it wasn't.
"Why the hell didn't they send one of those dark stars down to cover the mission?" Jack asked.
"I suppose it never occurred to anybody," Jackson said. They were back in the Situation Room.
"What about satellite overheads?"
"Not this time," Ed Foley advised. "Next passover is in about 4 hours. Clark has a satellite phone. He'll clue us in."
"Great."
Ryan leaned back in a chair that suddenly wasn't terribly comfortable.
"Objective in sight," Boyle said over the intercom, then the radio.
"Bandit 6 to Chicks, objective in sight. Check in, over." 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
"Cochise, check in."
"This is Cochise leader with 5. We have the objective."
"Crook with 5, objective in sight," the second attack helicopter team reported.
"Okay, move in as briefed. Execute, execute, execute."
Clark was perked up now, as were the troops in the back. Sleep was shaken off, and adrenaline flooded into their bloodstreams. He saw them shake their heads and flex their jaws. Weapons were tucked in tight, and every man moved his left hand to the twist dial release fitting on the belt buckle. Cochise flight went in first, heading for the barracks of the security battalion tasked to guard the missile base. The building could have been transported bodily from any World War II American Army base. A 2-story wood frame construction, with a pitched roof and painted white. There was a guard shack outside, also painted white, and it glowed in the thermal sights of the Apache gunners. They could even see the 2 soldiers there, doubtless approaching the end of their duty tour, standing slackly, their weapons slung over their shoulders, because nobody ever came out here, rarely enough during the day, and never in living memory at night. Unless you counted the battalion commander coming back drunk from a command staff meeting. Their heads twisted slightly when they thought they heard something strange. But the 4-bladed rotor on the Apache was also designed for sound suppression. And so they were still looking when they saw the first flash. The weapons selected were the 2.75-inch diameter free-flight rockets, carried in pods on the Apache's stub wings. 3 of the section of 5 handled the initial firing run, with 2 in reserve should the unexpected develop. They burned in low so as to conceal their silhouettes in the hills behind them, and opened up at 200 meters. The first salvo of 4 blew up the guard shack and its 2 sleepy guards. The noise would have been enough to awaken those in the barracks building, but the second salvo of rockets, this time 15 of them, got there before anyone inside could do more than blink his eyes open. Both floors of the 2-story structure were hit, and most of those inside died without waking, caught in the middle of dreams. The Apaches hesitated then, still having weapons to fire. There was a subsidiary guard post on the other side of the building. Cochise lead looped around the barracks and spotted it. The 2 soldiers there had their rifles up and fired blindly into the air. But his gunner selected his 20-millimeter cannon and swept them aside as though with a broom. Then the Apache pivoted in the air, and he salvoed his remaining rockets into the barracks. And it was immediately apparent that if anyone was alive in there, it was by the grace of God himself, and whoever it was would not be a danger to the mission. "Cochise 4 and 5, lead. Go back up Crook. We don't need you here."
Roger lead, they both replied. The two attack helicopters moved off, leaving the first three to look for and erase any signs of life. Crook Flight, also of five Apaches, smoked in just ahead of the Blackhawks. It turned out that each silo had a small guard post, each for two men, and those were disposed of in a matter of seconds with cannon fire. Then the Apaches climbed to higher altitude and circled slowly, each over a pair of missile silos, looking for anything moving but seeing nothing. Bandit 6, Colonel Dick Boyle, flared his Blackhawk 3 feet over silo number 1, as it was marked on his satellite photo. "Go!" the co-pilot shouted over the intercom. The Rainbow Troopers jumped down just to the east of the actual hole itself. The Chinese hat steel structure, which looked like an inverted blunt ice cream cone, prohibited dropping right down on the door itself. The base command post was the best protected structure on the entire post. It was buried 10 meters underground, and the 10 meters was solid reinforced concrete, so as to survive a nuclear bomb's exploding within 100 meters, or so the design supposedly promised. Inside was a staff of 10, commanded by Major General Shun Qingyan. He'd been a second artillery, the Chinese name for their strategic missile troops, officer, since graduating from university with an engineering degree. Only 3 hours before, he'd supervised the fueling of all 12 of his CSS-4 intercontinental ballistic missiles, which had never happened before in his memory. No explanation had come with that order, though it didn't take a rocket scientist, which he was by profession, to connect it with the war underway against Russia. Like all members of the People's Liberation Army, he was a highly disciplined man, and always mindful of the fact that he had his country's most valuable military assets under his personal control. The alarm had been raised by one of the silo guard posts, and his staff switched on the television cameras used for site inspection and surveillance. They were old cameras and needed lights, which were switched on as well. "What the fuck?" Chavez shouted. "Turn the lights off!" he ordered over his radio. It wasn't demanding. The light standards weren't very tall, nor were they very far away. Chavez hosed one with his MP10, and the lights went out, thank you. No other lasted for more than 5 seconds at any of the silos. "We are under attack," General Shun said in a quiet and disbelieving voice. "We are under attack," he repeated. But he had a drill for this. "Alert the guard force," he told one NCO. "Get me Beijing," he ordered another. At silo number 1, Paddy Connolly ran to the pipes that led to the top of the concrete box that marked the top of the silo. To each, he stuck a block of Composition B, his explosive of choice. Into each block, he inserted a blasting cap. Two men, Eddie Price and Hank Patterson, knelt close by with their weapons ready for a response force that was nowhere to be seen. "Fire in the hole!" Patterson shouted, running back to the other two. There he skidded down to the ground, sheltered behind the concrete, and twisted the handle on his detonator. The two pipes were blown apart a millisecond later. "Masks!" he told everyone on the radio. But there was no vapor coming off the fueling pipes. That was good news, wasn't it? "Come on!" Eddie Price yelled at him. The three men, guarded now by two others, looked for the metal door into the maintenance entrance for the silo. "Ed, we're on the ground, we're on the ground," Clark was saying into his satellite phone 50 yards away. "The barracks are gone and there's no opposition on the ground here. Doing our blasting now. Back to you soon. Out." "Well, shit," Ed Foley said in his office. But the line was now dead. What? It was an hour later in Beijing, and the sun was up. Marshal Luo, having just woken up after not enough sleep following the worst day he'd known since the Cultural Revolution, had a telephone thrust into his hands. "What is this?" he demanded of the phone. "This is Major General Shun Qingyan at Chuanwan Missile Base. We are under attack here. There is a force of men on the ground over our heads trying to destroy our missiles. I require instructions." "Fight them off," was the first idea Luo had. "The defense battalion is dead. They do not respond. Comrade Minister, what do I do?"
Are your missiles fueled and ready for launch?
Yes.
Luo looked around his bedroom, but there was no one to advise him. His country's most priceless assets were now about to be ripped from his control. His command wasn't automatic. He actually thought first, but in the end it wouldn't matter how considered his decision was.
Launch your missiles, he told the distant general officer.
Repeat your command, Luo heard.
Launch your missiles, his voice boomed. Launch your missiles now!
By your command, the voice replied.
Fuck, Sergeant Connolly said. This is some bloody door.
The first explosive block had done nothing more than scorch the paint. This time he attached a hollow charge to the upper and lower hinges and backed off again.
This one will do it, he promised as he trailed the wires back.
The crash that followed gave proof to his words. When next they looked in, the door was gone. It had been hurled inward. Must have flown into the silo like a bat out of...
Bloody hell!
Connolly turned.
Run! Run!
Price and Patterson needed no encouragement. They ran for their lives. Connolly caught them reaching for his protective hood as he did so, not stopping until he was over 100 yards away.
The bloody missile's fueled! The door ruptured the upper tank! It's going to blow!
Shit!
Team, this is Price. The missiles are fueled, I repeat, the missiles are fueled. Get the fucking hell away from the silo.
The proof of that came from silo number 8, off to Price's south. The concrete structure that sat atop it surged into the air, and under it was a volcanic blast of fire and smoke. Silo number 1, theirs, did the same, a gout of flame going sideways out of the open service door. The infrared signature was impossible to miss. Over the equator, a DSP satellite focused in on the thermal bloom and cross-loaded the signal to Sunnyvale, California. From there it went to NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, dug into the sub-basement level of Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado.
Launch! Possible launch at Chuanhua!
What's that? Asked Sync NORAD.
We got a bloom, a huge...
Two huge ones at Chuanhua, the female captain announced.
Fuck, there's another one!
Okay, Captain, settle down, the four-star told her. There's a special op taking that base down right now. Settle down, girl. In the control bunker, men were turning keys. The general in command had never really expected to do this. Sure, it was a possibility, the thing he'd trained his entire career for, but no, not this. No, not a chance. But someone was trying to destroy his command. And he did have his orders. And like the automaton he'd been trained to be, he gave the orders and turned his command key. The Spetsnaz people were doing well. 4 silos were now disabled. One of the Russian teams managed to crack the maintenance door on their first try. This team, General Karelin's own, sent its technical genius inside, and he found the missile's guidance module and blew it apart with gunfire. It would take a week at least to fix this missile, and just to make sure that didn't happen, he affixed an explosive charge to the stainless steel body and set the timer for 15 minutes.
Done, he called.
Out, Karelin ordered.
The lieutenant general, now feeling like a new cadet in parachute school, gathered his team and ran to the pickup point. As guilty as any man would be of mission focus, he looked around, surprised by the fire and flame to his north. But more surprised to see 3 silo covers moving. The nearest was only 300 meters away, and there he saw one of his Spetsnaz troopers walk right to the suddenly open silo and toss something in. Then he ran like a rabbit, because 3 seconds later, the hand grenade he'd tossed in exploded, and took the entire missile up with it. The Spetsnaz soldier disappeared in the fireball he'd caused, and would not be seen again. But then something worse happened. From exhaust vents set left and right of silos number 5 and number 7, came 2 vertical fountains of solid white-yellow flame, and less than 2 seconds later appeared the blunt, black shape of a missile's nose cone.
Fuck! Breathed the Apache pilot, coded Crook 2.
He was circling a kilometer away, and without any conscious thought at all, lowered his nose, twisted throttle, and pulled collective to jerk his attack helicopter at the rising missile.
Got it! The gunner called.
He selected his 20-millimeter cannon and held down the trigger.
The tracers blazed out like laser beams. The first set missed, but the gunner adjusted his lead and walked them into the missile's upper half. The resulting explosion threw Crook 2 out of control, rolling it over on its back. The pilot threw his cyclic to the left, continuing the roll before he stopped it, barely, a quarter of the way through the second one, and then he saw the fireball rising, and the burning missile fuel falling back to the ground, atop silo number 9, and on all the men there who'd disabled that bird. The last missile cleared its silo before the soldiers there could do much about it. 2 tried to shoot at it with their personal weapons, but the flaming exhaust incinerated them in less time than it takes to pull a trigger. Another Apache swept in, having seen what Crook 2 had accomplished, but its rounds fell short. So rapidly the CSS-4 climbed into the air.
"Oh, fuck!" Clark heard in his radio earpiece. It was Ding's voice. "Oh, fuck!"
John got back on his satellite phone.
"Yeah, how's it going?" Ed Foley asked.
"One got off. One got away, man."
"What?"
"You heard me. We killed all but one, but that one got off. Going north, but leaning east some."
"Sorry, Ed. We tried."
It took Foley a few seconds to gather his thought and reply.
"Thanks, John. I guess I have some things to do here."
"There's another one," the captain said. Sink NORAD was trying to play this one as cool as he could. Yes, there was a spec op laid on to take this Chinese missile farm down, and so he expected to see some hot flashes on the screen, and okay, all of them so far had been on the ground.
"That should be all of them," the general announced.
"Sir, this one's moving. This one's a launch."
"Are you sure?"
"Look, sir, the bloom is moving off the site," she said urgently. "Valid launch, valid launch, valid threat," she concluded. "Oh, my God."
"Oh, shit," Sink NORAD said.
He took one breath and lifted the gold phone. No, first he'd call the NMCC. The senior watch officer in the National Military Command Center was a Marine one-star named Sullivan. The NORAD phone didn't ring very often.
"NMCC, Brigadier General Sullivan speaking.
This is Sink NORAD. We have a valid launch, valid threat from Xuanwan Missile Base in China. I say again, we have a valid launch, valid threat from China. It's angling east, coming to North America."
"Fuck," the Marine observed.
"Tell me about it."
The procedures were all written down. His first call went to the White House military office. Ryan was sitting down to dinner with the family. An unusual night, he had nothing scheduled, no speeches to give, and that was good, because reporters always showed up and asked questions. And lately...
"Say that again," Andrea Price O'Day said into her sleeve microphone.
"What?"
Then another Secret Service agent bashed into the room. "Marching order," he proclaimed. It was a code phrase often practiced but never spoken in reality.
"What?"
Jack said, half a second before his wife could make the same sound.
"Mr. President, we have to get you and your family out of here," Andrea said. "The Marines have the helicopters on the way."
"What's happening?"
"Sir, NORAD reports an inbound ballistic threat."
"What, China?"
"That's all I know. Let's go, right now," Andrea said forcefully.
"Jack,"
Kathy said in alarm.
"Okay, Andrea." The president turned.
"Time to go, honey, right now."
"But what's happening?"
He got her to her feet first and walked to the door. The corridor was full of agents. Trenton Kelly was holding Kyle Daniel. The Lionesses were nowhere in sight. And the principal agents for all the other kids were there.